What does it mean to be humbled? Perhaps it's to lose some pride, to feel less important, even a little defeated. From the Latin humus, soil, to be brought down to earth, to bite the dust, to be laid low. In that sense, maybe a humbling can never actually be welcomed in as great. We would never wish for this encounter with mortality on a planetary scale, but here we are. If this is a humbling, then maybe it's about a regrounding, a reconnection in which we are being made to stare into the dark mirror and reflect on the reflection we see staring back at us. Perhaps there's a message in that image. My name's Ed Gillespie, and myself and my co-host Dougald Hine have spent the last 20 years trying to decipher and articulate that message. How will they look in hindsight, these strange times we are living through? Is this a midlife crisis on humanity's road to the Star Trek future, or the point at which that story of the future unraveled and we came to see how much it had left out? What if our current crises are neither an obstacle to be overcome, nor the end of the world, but a necessary humbling? In the early weeks of the coronavirus crisis and the extraordinary rupture of the everyday that it represents, we set out to explore what it means to be humbled.
Well, Ed, here we are. It's week 4 of our wanderings together, and we came up with the title this week, A Bestiary of Metaphors. So that's what we want to do, is spend some time with these creatures of the imagination. Some of them actually imaginary creatures, some of them other images. But this is going to be about walking with beasts, black elephants, green swans, impossible hamsters. But first, I think you have some nightingales.
Yeah, that's right. So last night I was honored and privileged enough to be working with the wonderful folk singer, Sam Lee, and a bunch of other creatives. And he was in a Sussex woodland doing a sort of live broadcast of the singing nightingales out onto the interweb. And loads of us were contributing songs and poetry. And it was extraordinarily beautiful. And I think there's something about the metaphor of the nightingale, because, you know, it's been the population has crashed by something like 95% in the last 50 years. And yet it's such a hugely culturally symbolic bird. Its music and its song is extraordinary, and it's inspired so many different artists. And it sort of brought me to this idea of Bertolt Brecht's quote, you know, in 1939, just before the start of the Second World War, where he wrote the motto to the Svenborg poem saying, "Will there be singing in the dark times?" He goes, "Yes, there will be singing about the dark times." And the Nightingale Night was a bit like that. You know, it's almost like a requiem for a species with these last little birds singing to us. And yet the evocation of that is extraordinarily moving. And they had a whole global audience actually tuned in, which was also gorgeous. You know, people sort of from New Zealand to Utah to Russia. And it struck me, this sort of interconnection that, you know, there's Sam squatting in this Sussex wood on an April night, and a whole global audience tuned in to hear the bird song that he's recording and these other contributions. And there's a fantastic intimacy to that in a pan-global way. And it struck me, you know, this connection of information and energy and food and this extraordinarily interconnected world we have. And yet that brought me to a quote I stumbled upon this week from Martin Rees, the wonderful Astronomer Royal, back in 2015, who said, "It's imperative to guard against the downsides of such an interconnected world. The magnitude of the societal breakdown from pandemics would be far higher than in earlier centuries. English villages in the 14th century continued to function even when the Black Death almost halved their populations. In contrast, our social framework would be vulnerable to breakdown as soon as hospitals overflowed and health services were overwhelmed, which could occur when the fatality rate was still a fraction of 1%. And I just thought, wow, okay, so we were talking last week about unimaginable futures, but clearly, you know, people like Martin Rees were distinctly able to envisage what might be coming down the track in this supposedly impossible situation in which we find ourselves. And that was sort of counterbalanced by an insight from the fact that Wimbledon tennis tournament actually took out £1 million a year pandemic insurance for the last 17 years, which has just paid out £100 million because obviously they've cancelled this year's tournament. Now, somebody has obviously sat in those board meetings for the last 17 years making the case for that massive insurance premium and is probably going to spend the rest of their career saying, I told you so, and giving downbeat leadership lectures on the circuit. But I think we are, as you touched on before, you know, we're also this week with the negative oil prices and the kind of the quite terrifying volatility, because it's not a good thing. You know, this should not be celebrated. This is actually incredibly disturbing for, you know, all sorts of reasons in terms of global geopolitical stability. But it plays to your aspect of every week, another thought experiment that might be unimaginable the week before seems to be rolling out in practice, which is incredibly discombobulating. And we are all feeling our way through the repercussions of. And my conclusion then was a kind of a quote from Lenin, who said, there are decades where nothing happens and there are weeks where decades happen.
And then sometimes those weeks just come back to back for months at a time. And that takes me back to 2011, when in Paul Mason's phrase, it was kicking off everywhere. And that kind of moment that seemed to start with the WikiLeaks embassy cables the previous autumn and then roll through these interconnected, networked tides of protest and unrest and possibility over the spring and summer into the autumn of 2011. And, you know, part of what I remember from being in the middle of all sorts of networks and conversations and publishing things and bringing things together during that time is there's a kind of giddiness that can come in those moments where it feels like history is running on fast forward. And obviously, you know, the dominant note right now is hardly giddiness when every news bulletin is led by the numbers of the dying. But there's still something that's worth tuning into there. I always think of those extraordinary images of the crowds in August 1914 cheering the outbreak of war and cheering the soldiers who are heading off to what became the Western Front. And I remember them showing us those images in school and how unimaginable that seemed. And then that spring of 2011, the Arab Spring, I remember the kind of giddiness rolling through the Twitter feeds as the protests spread from one country to another, to Egypt, to Libya, to Syria. And I remember having just an inkling at the time of, I suppose it was a hesitancy about joining in, how easy it is to join in a social media tide of cheering for something that is happening on the streets and to the bodies of people a long way away, most of whom you will never meet. Then I ended up moving to Sweden the following year and going through Swedish for Immigrants classes alongside guys my age or younger who had fled in the first wave, escaping from Syria as the hope of the revolution turned into the horror of what came next. And I feel a bit marked by that. Whenever I hear the voice that says, another world is possible, it can't be any worse than going back to normal, which is a phrase that I've heard people who I love dearly and whose intentions and activities I have loads of respect for, I've heard them, seen them use that in recent weeks. There's my old friend Vinay Gupta, who's a very bad man, likes to say a much, much worse world is possible.
I think the concern, like I was touching on with the oil prices, is you end up with this sort of cascade of crises. So one crisis starts to blend into another and escalate and exacerbate and extrematize it in ways that might not be predictable or imaginable.
Right. One glimpse of how that goes that we got this week that The Guardian picked up on and reported is this fall in CO2 production. Now, I mean, you and I and anyone else who has worked around climate change, our first reaction might be, that sounds like a really good thing. But as well as the vast output of CO2 as a negative externality of industrial activities, there is also this other thing, which is CO2 as a deliberate industrial product, a compressed gas that's used in processing, packing, preservation, shipping of foods, also critically in the treatment of drinking water. And it turns out, I didn't know this, industrial CO2 is a byproduct of ethanol production. And in some countries, ethanol is mixed in with petrol in the gasoline that is sold at the pumps. And because there's a lot less driving going on because of lockdown, 3/4 of the ethanol plants in the US have either mothballed or cut back their production. And the side effect of that is a cut in the amount of this compressed gas CO2. And so this report came from Washington State, where the US coronavirus outbreak first took root, of the impact of the national shortage of CO2, where water treatment plants were being told by their suppliers that they would only receive 1/3 of their usual supply of this essential ingredient within the process by which they take water and make it drinkable for populations of cities. So I guess that's just sort of one glimpse of the supply chain weirdness that's going on in the background of everything else at the moment, and that contains the seeds of how we could find ourselves incredibly quickly spiraling into a much, much worse world. And I just feel like that sobriety is kind of called for. So the other thing that I wanted to share this week, not something I've been reading, but something I was listening to, a recording, not exactly a podcast, but you can find it on SoundCloud, Stephen Jenkinson, who is a sobering voice at the best of times. He's a writer and teacher, a fairly old man in Canada. He has a school called the Orphan Wisdom School. And he worked for a long time in what he calls the death trade. He worked with people and families of people who were dying. And he's written a couple of books. He's got a voice that for some people it might be a bit of an acquired taste. He's got a touch of the old time preacher to him, I would say. But there are various things he said on this recording, which is basically an hour and a half of him answering questions from friends and collaborators. And he says something at one point about how the instinct to get on the other side, to get out the far end of the crisis, this instinct is a traumatized instinct. And that really spoke to me. And it spoke to me about this hesitancy that I've had around some of the rush to frame stories and narratives and how... My mum had a horrible accident last year, and we had 11 days when she was in the hospital, and we didn't know how any of it was going to play out. And I remember in my own reactions and in the reactions of other people in the family, one of the impulses I was aware of is the kind of the rush to get out the other side. You really want to hear the words that the doctors say in a way that is maybe more optimistic than you actually have a right to interpret them as being. Because that's a way of, you know, getting past the trauma, getting past the discomfort. And I guess it's that thing that I want to name is, you know, the rush forward into relief, even imaginatively by dwelling in the beautiful possibilities of another world on the far side. It can be an escape from dwelling with the trauma of the world we're in right now. So what's the alternative to that? I guess my suggestion would be that we have to sit with the discomfort, sit through it, because if your attempts to create and narrate hope are a way of avoiding that discomfort, then they are going that's going to cloud them It's going to set them off course. And there's a bit where Stephen says in this recording, do I think we're going to seize this moment as a collective? I doubt it. Is it there to be seen anyway? Yes, it is. And he talks about these little pockets of sanity and lucidity that aren't seduced by the old seduction of getting back on with our lives. And just gestures towards this idea that those pockets might play a disproportionate role, that they might be the source of inspiration in times to come. And that, to me, you know, it's not the answer to anything, but it's an example of what a humbler kind of hope might sound like.
I think there's something quite potent at the heart of that, alongside this idea of sort of unlearning, where we have to sort of resist the lure and pull of the familiar, even though, you know, in discomforting and uncertain times, that actually feels quite comforting to go back to. You know, I've been wrestling with that notion myself this week in this idea that the unknown may hold more value than the known. So whilst we are lurching towards our galvanized action stations and trying to fix things and patch things up, are we shutting down far bigger opportunities which may lie in that uncertainty? And I heard a really interesting talk by Marion Waller, who's a sort of planning advisor to the mayor of Paris, who was talking about the urgent need to redesign the center of the city. Because obviously the logical solution to social distancing is for everyone to get in their cars, which would create absolute gridlock and logjam and bedlam. You know, Paris is one of the most high density cities in the world, certainly the center of Paris. And she was describing this sort of tactical urbanism that they were going to have to really experiment with. And she was talking about the rapid experimental change using people, because in order to maintain social distancing on pavements, for example, they were going to have to take road space. They were going to actually have to encroach onto the roads in order to create pavements at least 2.5 meters wide. Or ideally wider. And obviously you've got that on places like the Champs-Élysées, but in a lot of Paris, you don't. And she was saying this could be a sort of radical reimagination of a lot of the center of Paris, because a lot of roads will have to be shut. And she said, we can't do this all through hard concrete and basically infrastructural solutions. We're going to use people as infrastructure and people's behavior and practice and cultural endeavors as a sort of soft infrastructure. And I love that idea of the sort of city as forest, not machine, where we can, the human life can grow into the road, if you like, to reclaim it from the automobile. And I think that metaphor of forest, not machine is a really powerful thing. It creates that playful space where, you know, the tactical urbanism that she's suggesting could be very quick and could be rolled out almost on a daily experimental basis just to see what works. And I love that idea of flexibility and fluidity. And I think that metaphor is really powerful.
There's a glimpse there, isn't there, of the kinds of creativity that are going to be called for and are going to be part of the mix as we begin to move past the first tight phase of lockdown and find ways of living with the easing of restrictions, and also living with the becoming longer term of some of the restrictions that can't be lifted at this stage. And that thing you said about metaphor too, I think it's worth digging in a little bit to the nature of metaphor. A metaphor isn't like a crossword clue, which has a kind of one-to-one solution. It's not a kind of clever game where when you get it, you know what's being talked about. It's weirder and more fertile than that. And this is part of the sense in which metaphors are tools for working with the unknown, things that can't be fully known or controlled, that kind of come back to surprise you. I remember Martin Shaw saying to me the first time I sat down and talked with him, he said, you know, you did something really smart when you created Dark Mountain because you gave it an image as a name. Part of what he was getting at is that an image can be approached from multiple directions, including ones that you, as the people who have offered that image in the first place haven't thought of. So that image of the Dark Mountain comes from a poem by Robinson Jeffers that Paul had found before he and I even met and started working together. And this line about the dance of the dream-led masses down the Dark Mountain. And maybe you've got the sense of this, the mountain and its non-human vastness in relation to the smallness and fragility of the human, and that's part of that. But as the years went by and I was kind of involved in holding the space of the heart of Dark Mountain and learning what that might mean, it also came to have all of these resonances for me about the mountain as the place of retreat in both the spiritual and the military sense of that terms, and the sense that part of what we were doing was creating a space where you came back from the front line of your everyday. And that had the advantage that you could look down and get a longer perspective than you can get when you're in the throng of the everyday. But also as a kind of humbling thing, which is that you don't get to act from that distance. You can't act from up on the mountain. You have to find your way back down again and see which bits of the insight and perspective you got up there still make sense when you've re-entered the everyday. And now, you know, Dark Mountain is in the hands of Charlotte Ducan and Nick Hunt and all these wonderful people who are taking it forward. The 17th book just landed through my letterbox this week, and it's beautiful. And it's beautiful to read it without having had any involvement or ahead of time view of it. And I'm sure that that image, that metaphor of the mountain, will come to mean other things to them that Paul and I never thought of.
You just remind me what my mum always used to say, which my mum was is a fantastic cook, and she always said, you know, there's nothing more delicious than a meal you haven't cooked yourself. So yeah, I think that works for your, as a metaphor for your digestion of the latest Dark Mountain. And I think you're right. And I think Martin often says that about the myth as well, doesn't he? He's like, you can't always pin it down. It's not supposed to be a detailed explanation. It's supposed to be a provocation. It's supposed to be a way of jarring your thinking out of its comfort zone. And I think there's a whole suite of metaphors, you know, a bit like the story arcs we talked about in episode one that are currently out there. And on Friday evening, I participated in a session with Phoebe Tickell's Moral Imaginations, and she was using this train metaphor. She's saying, you know, we've been on a train that's been hurtling towards a cliff edge. You know, it's actually an irreversible cliff edge. And once we're off it, there's no way of winding the train back over it or stopping it once we've gone off that particular cliff edge. And it's as if the pandemic has basically created a fire in one of the carriages and it's made us stop the train. And suddenly we've looked outside and we're going, why are we on this train hurtling towards this cliff edge? We need to stop this train. And it really resonated with what we were talking about in terms of E.M. Forster's The Machine Stops, you know, and that absurdity of everyone rushing around. Some people are trying to fix the fire on the train. Some people want to fix the track, bend it around. Some people are trying to build a bridge over the canyon. And it was interesting in that session with the Moral Imaginations crew, people instantly started trying to pick apart why the metaphor wasn't representative enough. It's like, and almost sort of killing the metaphor itself by trying to describe why it wasn't accurate.
This is the danger of treating the metaphor as if it is meant to be literal, as if it is meant to make sense, rather than to help you at the place where things stop making sense, and then to be generative of surprises in that space.
Yeah, exactly. And there's another one, you know, another transport one, I guess, is the boat metaphor, where it's saying we're all facing the same storm, but in very different boats, which I think flushes out some of these ideas around, you know, the great leveler, but also the great inequality of this moment in the terms of the pandemic. I think the war metaphor is everywhere. You know, you watch the news and it can feel like an action movie. We have this very strong idea of the front line, you know, this kind of courageous NHS workers. There's a sort of sense of victimhood and sacrifice, and this, you are somehow fodder for forces greater than yourself. I had a really interesting conversation with my friend Professor Jonathan Gosling about this. He's saying, you know, so much of the terminology here is the military logistics, command and control planning, you know, almost the clapping of the troops on a Thursday night at 8 p.m. and the PPE crisis is like weapons without ammunition, or, you know, troops in Iraq during the Gulf War not having chemical weapons suits. It's, you know, these are very familiar metaphors to a lot of us. And then at the flip side of that is, you know, I saw a seminar with Liz Gilbert saying, you know, We're using the language of war, but this is not a war. No one's trying to kill each other here. Actually, we're all trying to help each other. So we've got this really awkward juxtaposition of this, you know, very familiar, entrenched military vernacular. And yet, arguably, this is the biggest humanitarian thing we're ever trying to do collectively. And she was saying, arguably, the world is saner right now than it was before. That doesn't mean it's safer, but it's certainly saner in some ways. And then I think there's the sort of fake news telecoms metaphor, where, you know, a lot of what we're trying to do in terms of the spread of the virus is interrupting this transmission, the breaking of those transmission lines. And we see that as sort of telegraph cables or internet connections in our heads, or the pollutant in the system, the communication of bad messages. You know, the virus is almost like a fake news of our immune system. It's really, really compromising us in a dangerous way. And then, on a slightly more playful note, you know, my friend Ed Dowding shared the video clip of the final scene from The Italian Job.
Oh, yeah.
You know, where they're all in the coach winding through the Alps with the gold in the back of the bus, and they've gone off the hairpin bend and the bus is left balancing precariously on the precipice of the cliff. And they're all at one end of the bus and the gold is at the other, hanging over the edge. But in order to get the gold, they're going to have to move down the bus and thereby tip the coach into the chasm. And, you know, and it's wonderful, but except for the fact that, you know, there's no one here saying, don't worry, boys, I've got a plan, or I think I've got an idea, which I think is the immortal line. So it's a sort of playful one. It's like, we want the gold, but is it going to take us over the edge? And last, but by no means least, and this is actually a metaphor that, you know, again, I have to say that I have used many times over the last 20 years, is, you know, the classic old Buckminster Fuller spaceship Earth. We are on this rock hurtling through space with several billion of us, with no operating instructions or manual for the machine. None of us are passengers. We're all crew, and we somehow have to work out how this thing operates safely.
Yeah.
And Ellen MacArthur obviously talks about that too, in the notion of her sailing experiences, where when you're at sea, what you've got is all you've got, and you have to be ingenious and innovative with what's working there. But,
well, that spaceship Earth metaphor is worth just pausing on that for a moment, because that's one that's had a massive influence on the environmental movement via Stuart Brand and the whole Earth catalogue, and this kind of vision that Brand had in the 60s of, you know, why haven't we seen the image of the whole Earth from space yet? And that when we did get to see that image, it would facilitate this collective shift to a higher level of consciousness. And, well, we just had Earth Day this week, and, you know, we've been having those since the 70s, and that's all kind of focused around that image. There's a really interesting moment in that Stephen Jenkinson recording that I was talking about, where he's musing on the virus and what this moment might be. And he kind of says, oh, it's like we're offered something right now that replaces the image of the Earth seen from space with the Earth seen from Earth. And to me, that's very much an image of the humbling. It echoes something we'll probably come back to as these conversations go on, from Ivan Illich, who I was talking about last week, in the closing pages of Deschooling Society, one of his most famous books, where he almost says getting to the moon was the easy part. It's finding our way home again. That's the real work that has been called for since the, you know, that coming to awareness of environmental crisis in the 60s and 70s.
Maybe the kind of the transition there then is from away from these sort of man-made metaphors or human crafted metaphors back into the sort of the more rooted in nature, natural metaphors. And so you and I have put together a little sort of metaphorical bestiary of the various different animalistic metaphors that are out there. I mean, we know that Nassim Taleb wrote about black swans, you know, these huge game-changing events which are completely unforeseen, and we tend to sort of rationalize them in hindsight and try and make sense of them. And obviously the arrival of the internet and even 9/11 are things like that. Climate, if you like, is the white swan, I think. And, you know, you and I have worked on it for 20 years, but we've known about the climate challenge, if you like, for a, almost 150 years. So that's a sort of white swan. It's grimly predictable. It's totally foreseen. It's built and it's still game changing, perhaps in a slightly more terrifying way. And then my good friend John Elkington's got a new book out this week called Green Swans. And John's written obviously 20 books or so over the course of the years in regard to the corporate world and sustainability and social responsibility. And he's talking about green swans as, you know, the exponential regenerative businesses, this coming sort of boom in regenerative capitalism. And I think there's some interest in that, although I would caveat that with some of the cautious principles that you and I have already discussed about exponential growth of any kind. And I'll come back onto that in a moment.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it, how these animal images come through, not just in the kind of myths and stories that somebody like Martin Shaw works with, but even in these kind of business books. It reminds me of when you become a parent and you've got a young child, suddenly all these animals come into your world. In the books, in the clothes, in the stuff, the, you know, the stuff that you put up on the wall. And it's like, if you are already living with an awareness of living in an age of mass extinction, it can be quite painful, the kind of tension. But there's also some clue there about our deep need to be accompanied by the other creatures. I remember Göran Greider, the Swedish journalist, in one of his books talks about the kind of kitsch paintings of images of paintings of deer or whatever it is that appear in on the walls in small town homes, and the kind of thing that's sort of sneered at by the cultured. But he talks about how much of an echo this is of cave paintings, like how we still have these very deep needs to be accompanied by the other creatures. So when you've got your flock of swans there, the black swan, the white swan, the green swan, I have to tell the story of the black elephant. So I mentioned Vinay Gupta. Vinay, I mean, these days he's probably kind of best known to a lot of people as this crypto guru, been very involved in a lot of blockchain stuff, the launch of Ethereum. Always known as the inventor of the Hexayurt that gets built by lots of people as their shelters to live in when they go to Burning Man Festival, although it was originally invented as an open source shelter design for refugees. Vinay and I used to knock around together a lot in London, sort of circa 2009, 2010, and we were part of this semi-fictional outfit called the Institute for Collapsonomics. Semi-fictional because I'm not sure we ever actually billed for any work through that, but we used to kind of gatecrash respectable think tank events and ask difficult questions and generally behave in ways that didn't endear us to the London policy world. And after a particularly fruitless conversation at Nesta, we were walking out and Lloyd Davis, who is another of our associates in that era, he came out with this thing of, what we were dealing with wasn't black swans. It wasn't the elephant in the room. It was the black elephant. The black elephant is the thing that was the elephant in the room. So it was the thing that, you know, everyone can see, but no one wants to talk about. But when it comes along, everyone will try and pretend that it was a black swan, that it was unforeseeable. And in a sense there, that takes us back to your Martin Rees quote that you started with. That is... You know, there's nothing black swan about this pandemic. I mean, I remember actually Vinay and I sitting down with a Downing Street advisor in 2009 in the early weeks of the swine flu pandemic before it became clear that that was going to turn out to be a lot milder than was feared from the first numbers coming out of Mexico. And just talking with this guy and having this realization that, you know, the thought that was going through his head was not what is the right thing to do? It was, how will the papers react to this? And that was a slightly chilling glimpse into the political calculus that goes on in a moment like this. So it's not like we haven't known that there was a big pandemic coming. But yeah, the black elephant is the kind of what can happen in the political conversation, that the thing that was really an elephant in the room gets talked about as if no one could possibly have foreseen or planned for this.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I mean, I've given a couple of talks to the army, weirdly, on climate change and climate risk on precisely that basis, and used the black elephant example, as you say, because it exactly. Well, everyone will try and say, yes, well, of course we couldn't have seen this coming. And funny enough, in military metaphors, they actually talk about black jellyfish, which are sort of superficially simple. So we think we know. This plays to this knowing piece. Mm. We think we know, we understand, we think we're in control, but actually we think they're quite primitive, you know, but actually, you know, the more you understand the jellyfish, the more you realize how infinitely complex they are. And they actually have a really nasty sting in the tail. So it's one of those situations where you think everything's going fine. And it's like, you've realized you've completely underestimated the complexity and then you're getting stung.
So we've got the black elephant, we've got the various colours of swans, we've got the black jellyfish. Tell me about the impossible hamster.
Yeah, well, I mean, I put this in as a sort of moment of relative levity, but this was a cartoon created by my friend Leo Murray many years ago, because what he was talking about, and this was in the context of infinite growth, and we'll share the link to the cartoon, but essentially it's about a 9 billion ton hamster, which, you know, because a hamster doubles its weight every other day whilst it's growing. And it's basically playing on this reason why nature has finite growth. Because obviously, if you don't want to be terrified by a King Kong size hamster rampaging through your city, then we have to address that kind of that infinite growth. And I think that sort of, yeah, it comes from this idea that, yeah, actually, none of us is safe from that impossible hamster. No one expects actually an impossible hamster. And it goes back to what you were saying earlier in terms of, you know, metaphor isn't safe. It's not supposed to be. It's supposed to be about walking with beasts. It's supposed to be a bit dangerous and subversive, you know, that these things come out that we're not expecting, that's beyond our control, that it makes us perceive the world differently in a way that we can't always put our finger on why. And I'm left, you know, with this quote, which I think has been doing the rounds again this week, which I think comes from its origins in the civil rights movement. It feels very timeless. And in the civil rights movement, they would say none of us are free until all of us are free. But the mantra now with the pandemic is none of us is safe until all of us are safe. And that really, I think that's a very deep recognition of some inextricable solidarity that will have to be coming through in the coming weeks and months if we are going to be reconciling some of the emerging tensions that are already bubbling as a result of the crisis.
Mm. And then, without taking away from any of that, and especially without taking away from the need for solidarity, there's something to be added, which is none of us is safe, full stop. And I think of some lines from Helen Keller, this deaf blind woman from Alabama who was an activist in the Socialist Party of America and the Wobblies, and basically the least likely person, or one of the less likely people to have her words quoted in corporate motivational talks. But I first met these in a talk at a sales company that I was working at when I was a student. And I traced it back, and it comes from a book called Let Us Have Faith that Helen Keller wrote when she was already, I guess she must have been about 60 by this stage, in 1940, in a dark time in the world. And if you want somewhere to go for a grounded hope rather than a traumatized hope, then it's worth digging that book out. I found a PDF of it online this week. But these are the really famous lines that she wrote. Security is mostly a superstition. It does not exist in nature, nor do the children of men as a whole experience it. Avoiding danger is no safer in the long run than outright exposure. Life is either a daring adventure or nothing. Wouldn't it be something if whatever we may get to take responsibility for in the unknown world that lies ahead, if it could be grounded in that spirit and that faith?
Thank you for listening to The Great Humbling. These are astonishing times to be living in. Times in which many things are revealed, uncovered, brought into a new light. We see this podcast as very much an exploration, not a prescription. A provisional investigation that maybe loves questions more than answers to begin with, and needs a little time and space to breathe. This is an unscripted conversation, a wandering, if you will. And as Tolkien said, not all those who wander are lost. We plan this as a series of informal and roving conversations as we all adventure into uncharted internal and external territories. For us, daring to dream beyond the current urgency does not dismiss or disrespect it. Rather, it honours it. Whether we like it or not, our futures are already being decided today. Please do comment, ask questions and respond. You can find us on Facebook at The Great Humbling. This is initiation at a cultural scale. Please come and join us on this emergent journey.